The five biggest stories.
I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story.
Five opinions.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yada, yada, yada.
Each and every week.
That would be great.
This is the Intersection Podcast with Jason Page.
Fantastic.
Here's Jason.
Thank you kindly, Chad Erickson. Good to be with you. Thank you for joining us for another episode inside the Intersection Podcast. We got a lot to tackle inside this episode, including a snooze fest for Super Bowl 55 in Tampa Bay. We'll have part one of my conversation with Nobel Peace Prize winner Beatrice Finn coming up. This is something, I gotta tell you, I've really been looking forward to. An in-depth conversation on her hopes for a denuclearized planet. But we begin this week's countdown with what is sure to be an interesting week in Washington, D.C. The impeachment trial of former President Donald J. Trump is getting underway.
Number five.
Now, I'm not suffering from any sort of delusion. The Republican Party isn't going to impeach Donald Trump. Anyone can see that. Short of a Perry Mason moment coming to fruition, the fear factor is way too high amongst a large portion of the GOP senators that'll cast the final word on Trump's actions, both leading up to and on the day of the insurrection attempt at the Capitol. But let me give you some examples from those that have courage and those that sorely lack it. First, take Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney. She was one of the first and loudest to stand up and impugn Trump for the attack on the Capitol. Last week, she withstood a challenge to her seat of power amongst the House GOP members. And on Sunday, take a listen to this exchange with Chris Wallace over at Fox News.
I just want to ask you one more question about January 6th. When you voted to impeach the president, you said this. He, quote, summoned this mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack. Everything that followed was his doing. There has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution. Congresswoman, one of the things you certainly are is a straight talker. Would you vote to convict President Trump of incitement of insurrection?
If I were in the Senate, I would obviously listen to the evidence. I think that that's the role the Senate has as jurors. I would also point out, though, Chris, that the Senate trial is a snapshot. There is a massive criminal investigation underway. There will be a massive criminal investigation of everything that happened on January 6th and in the days before. People will want to know exactly what the president was doing. They will want to know, for example, whether the tweet that he sent out calling Vice President Pence a coward while the attack was underway, whether that tweet, for example, was a premeditated effort to provoke violence. There are a lot of questions that have to be answered, and there will be many, many criminal investigations looking at every aspect of this, at everyone who was involved, as there should be. But I stand firmly by my statement. We've never seen that kind of an assault by a president of the United States on another branch of government, and that can never happen again.
So just to press that, if you were in the Senate, would you vote to convict?
If I were in the Senate, I would listen to the testimony. I would listen to the evidence. If you're a senator, you have a responsibility to be a juror, and I think that's very important. But I obviously believe and did then that what we already know is enough for his impeachment. What we already know does constitute the gravest violation of his oath of office by any president in the history of the country. And this is not something that we can simply look past or pretend didn't happen or try to move on. We've got to make sure this never happens again.
By the way, some interesting reporting from Axios as well in the last several hours. They actually have intel from inside that House GOP meeting from last week that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy wanted Cheney to apologize to the Republicans gathered for her vote to impeach Trump. It's insanity. Next up, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. When confronted with the evidence of Trump's incitement of the January 6th mob, this was how he handled the questioning of Chris Wallace.
Senator, you talk about other people who have said things, but you know, there had been weeks of misrepresentations about the election. Then he called people to come to Washington. Then he talks about fighting like hell. People in the crowd are talking about going to the Capitol, and then they demand to find Speaker Pelosi and to hang Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States. Is that not incitement for insurrection?
I don't condone any of the language. And like I say, I opposed philosophically and voted against overturning the election. However, I think you're going to see the Trump defense play video of Maxine Waters telling crowds to mob Trump administration and restaurants and attack them. They'll probably show clips of Cory Booker saying, get up in their face of these congresspeople. You'll probably see comments from Representative Omar wishing and celebrating the violence that happened to me when I had six ribs broken and part of my lung removed. I think you're going to see all of this, and people are going to have to judge for themselves. Are we going to impeach and potentially criminally prosecute people for political speech when they get, say, get up and fight for your country, let your voices be heard? Has nobody in this country heard of figurative speech? You can argue that his position was wrong and that it was misguided. I accept all of that. But if you're going to criminalize his speech, you have to do it with the same standard. You can't just criminalize Republican speech and ignore all the Democrats who have incited violence. Look at the mayor of Seattle. She went on and on about this being a summer of love. Kamala Harris went forward and said, we should bail out these violent protesters. One of them has gotten out three times, committed crimes three times, including cracking the skull, fracturing the skull, and causing a brain injury after Kamala Harris advocated for getting him out of prison. So the thing is we can't just have a double standard. Both parties have to be treated the same. Okay. I think Democrats had any bit of self-reflection, they would be saying this is a really terrible idea.
Now, as it relates to the Republican Party, Cheney is nothing short of a profile in courage. While Rand Paul exhibits something between that gunk that sits on the inside of your toilet brush holster and that gum at the bottom of your shoe that just won't seem to wash off, no matter what you do. As for where public sentiment lies, not that it matters as far as the GOP is concerned, a Quinnipiac poll released late last week shows 56% of Americans, 56%, believing the former president should be impeached and barred from holding future office, while 41% believe Trump should be acquitted. Now to our next story, and it's one that we're all feeling no matter where you are in the world.
Number four.
Yep, it's the coronavirus. It continues to wreak havoc on all of our lives in one fashion or another, and we may apparently be getting closer to finding out how it ultimately came to be. According to reporting from both Reuters and Bloomberg, a New York-based zoologist helping out the World Health Organization is giving some clues ahead of the release of findings that could come in the next day or so. Dr. Peter Daszak is currently in Wuhan. He says a 14-member group worked with experts in China to find, quote, some real clues on what happened, end quote. The doctor says he hopes that the information being collected will help to prevent the next potential pandemic before it begins. Worldwide, COVID-19 has caused more than 105.7 million infections. Think about that number for a second. And again, that may not even be everybody that was infected. That's just what we know of. It's also accounted for 2.3 million deaths worldwide. How many of those could have been avoided? It's something that infectious disease specialists will be discussing for years to come. Our number three and number two items on the countdown this week is really a treat for the podcast.
And now, the Intersection Interview.
It's rare that I get to interview a Nobel Peace Prize winner, so when the opportunity came, and it was a topic I was passionate about, I had to jump at it. Beatrice Finn is the executive director at ICAN. That's the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. In 2017, she, along with the organization, won a Nobel Peace Prize for their work in building a worldwide coalition that signed a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. And while the nine nuclear powers refused to sign that treaty, it was one of the most forceful statements yet of the support for a denuclearized planet. In recent days, I had the opportunity to have an extended conversation with Beatrice Finn about a host of topics related to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. We'll give you part one of that conversation in today's podcast. Part two of that conversation will be available tomorrow, wherever you subscribe to our podcast. In fact, by the time you listen to this, it may already be available. And now, my conversation with Nobel Peace Prize winner Beatrice Finn. In the overall scheme of things, of all the things we're talking about in the world right now, post-Donald Trump in the U.S., where I just moved here from, here in Singapore. You know, we're talking about COVID. We're talking about all these different issues. It feels like, in some regards, the issue of nuclear proliferation kind of gets put on the back burner. And I know Tony Blinken and the State Department are doing some things, but I grew up on the back end of the Cold War. Okay, I'm 43. I'm a little older than you. But I grew up on the back end of the Cold War. So I had a little understanding of the idea that the United States and then the Soviet Union had nuclear arsenals. Never felt like there was a threat of them being used, though. Then you have the fall of the Berlin Wall, Cold War, you know, history lesson and all that, basically over a couple of years later. You had an organization dedicated to the elimination of nuclear weapons. But I sometimes wonder how many people view this topic of nuclear proliferation when Hiroshima is so far back in the history books in the 40s. I mean, hell, 9/11 is 25 or whatever, 20 years old. I mean, there's kids growing up today that don't even know anything of 9/11, let alone Hiroshima. It feels like in a world that's constantly moving from crisis to crisis and doesn't linger much on anything, how difficult does that make your mission more of a challenge from the standpoint of trying to get the everyday person to take the threat seriously?
I mean, that's really hitting the straight to the key issue here and the key problem of nuclear weapons. It is difficult, right? Because, and I think it's not so much about the topic in itself only, it's also human nature, right? We're really bad at thinking about sort of preventing things in advance. And it's really easy to postpone those kind of that kind of work until it happens. And I think we've seen that a little bit with the pandemic now, or even climate change. You know, I work here in Geneva. I have a lot of friends who work at the World Health Organization. And before this work, I was also involved a little bit in preventing bioweapons. So I've talked a lot to these kind of health researchers and experts that work on WHO and pandemics. And they've been saying for decades, a pandemic is coming. Right, like they have said that many, many times. The WHO has said it many times. Yet we're taken completely off guard.
The Obama administration, the Obama administration had said it was coming. Yeah. even several years ago.
Even we saw it in like starting in China, and then still like, no, it's not going to come here. You know, it's like, you know, human nature is really bad at kind of dealing with things before it's a crisis. But there are certain issues. Pandemics, of course, we're seeing now. Climate change, and I think in particular nuclear war, that is just, you cannot deal with it afterwards. Like, you know, and I think the same thing, like the huge kind of movement against climate change really ignited a couple of years ago when it got hotter, when people felt it. The problem with nuclear weapons is, though, when you feel it, it's too late. So it's like a non-issue until it's the only issue.
Isn't that human nature, though? Isn't it human nature that nobody reacts to anything? When does somebody generally care about gun violence? When it impacts them? When does somebody care about drunk driving? You know, mothers against drunk driving. When do people care? When one of their loved ones gets killed by a drunk driver. I had a friend get killed by a drunk driver 3 years ago. None of us ever cared about drunk driving. One of your friends gets killed. Now, all of a sudden, it's your cause celeb. And you can go on and on in that matter.
Yeah, but I think... Yeah, and I would say that relates to, you know, we can deal with the issues when we connect with it, right? When we understand it on a human level, and not just the facts, but when we connect it. It doesn't have to happen to ourselves, but we need to see, we need to kind of visualize it, and we need to feel something for it. So really what we've been trying to do is really start kind of over. The conversation around nonproliferation and nuclear disarmament has for long been very focused on the technical stuff, number of warheads, strategic stability between the United States and Russia. It's power games between Putin and Kim Jong-un and Modi and Netanyahu and all of these kind of, you know, actors. And what we're trying to do in order to connect with people is to really look at it first, you know, from a human level, look at the impact of nuclear weapons, like not the strategic numbers game of warheads and missiles, but what does radiation do to people? What are the targets of these things? What happened long-term? We're also looking at things like nuclear testing, for example, that it's not just Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's been over 2,000 tests of nuclear weapons with devastating impact on indigenous communities, former colonies, for example. And I think that ties together very much with this conversation that we're having now globally about racism. Which policies protect us? Who is in charge of protecting us, and who does that actually protect? Because nuclear weapons is seen as this kind of security guarantee, but mainly for the people in power, not for the communities in Nevada or New Mexico, for example, where nuclear weapons were used or tested, or not in Marshall Islands. not in Algeria where the French government tested, not in the Pacific Islands where the French and the British tested. So there's this kind of idea that, you know, there, it is actually ongoing harm. And then, you know, we're also trying to connect to people with looking at things like, you know, how do you see security? What protects you? And I think that this is a, you know, a perfect example now during the pandemic. Like the United States spends like $35 billion a year on nuclear weapons. It can't pay $2,000 to people that have lost their jobs and have no source of income because of shutdowns. Right. Like, so, and you know, you don't have healthcare, but there's like blank checks to the weapons companies in even the COVID relief package. There was more money going to the weapons companies than went to the American people. So, you know, again, like who protects who and who makes the decision on what security is? Maybe it's not the military that protects us. Maybe it's the nurses and the delivery people at the moment that are actually keeping us safe and alive these days. So I think, you know, in a way, our the way that we can kind of get people to think about this issue, I think, is to broaden it a little bit as well and not talk too much about the number of warheads, right, and the technical stuff, but to really kind of connect this to broader movements of economic justice, of healthcare, of budgetary kind of conversations, about human security, like what protects people, about gender equality, anti-racism, and so we're trying to connect this like to a bigger issue so that people don't have to prioritize just this, but can, it can be a part of a like a number of issues that we're pushing.
How difficult have you found it to break through to that younger audience that is so invested in those other causes? How hard is it to push this one? You know, let's be honest, people only have so much bandwidth. You know what I mean? Mm. So in that regard, how difficult is that for you?
I think it's definitely a challenge. I think that it's definitely possible. You just have to do it in an honest way. I think one of the good things about this issue is that almost everyone knows what a nuclear weapon is. So there's, you know, they have the mushroom cloud, sure, radiation, it's bad, right? So there's a level of understanding, even if they might not know so much detail about it, they know that most people think nuclear weapons are bad. And actually consistent polling that we do shows that most people want to get rid of nuclear weapons. The lack of problem, I think, is that there's very little confidence in that we can do something about it. And I think that that is the biggest challenge. So for me, I think that, you know, I meet a lot of young people. I talk a lot I used to when we were able to travel and stuff, do a lot of lectures at universities or even high school sometimes. And I think that there is an interest, but there's just like, it feels very, you know, they just feel a little bit hopeless and demoralized about the prospects. And I think that's where ICAN comes in. And the work that we've done with the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons can also serve as inspiration and as, you know, building up people's confidence that this is not something for a DC think tank, men in suit with all the academic knowledge and PhD in nuclear physics. This is something that a regular person can speak about. Because there is this kind of the conversation about nuclear weapons is so kind of expert focused that mm-hmm. it intentionally tries to discourage people from engaging. And I think we see that in a lot of other issues as well. It's like, well, what do you actually know? And look at the Fridays for Future and the climate change kids. Like, oh, you're just kids. You don't understand.
Right.
Like an intentional way to dismiss people, to make them feel like they don't have the right to talk about it. So I think once people get over that, it starts to get easy. But then, of course, I mean, there's no lack of issues to fight today. I mean, there's so many things that are happening that we need to tackle. So I also think we need to respect people's like limits in bandwidth. But that's why I also believe very much in these kind of organizations that work on it, that not everyone has to be on the barricades. Not everyone has to devote their lives. But you can also just support an organization, right? Like that, it doesn't have to take a lot of time. You can just kind of like amplify them, maybe contribute with a little bit of a monthly donation, or maybe like retweet their tweets or just share those things. And that by kind of multiplying the impact of what someone who then has the staff that can do it full time can do.
Being a recent expat of the United States, let me hit the obvious questions here. How much did Donald Trump as president age you over the last 4 years, given the rhetoric, the immaturity, the lack of understanding of many political issues around the world, and probably nuclear weapons falls into that category. I mean, how much sleep did you lose knowing you could wake up one morning and Donald Trump just happened to, you know what, let's fire off those nuclear codes. Why not? You know, I mean, the whole back and forth with Kim Jong-un before they started exchanging flowery love letters and all. I mean, I can't imagine how somebody in your position went to sleep at night knowing that that situation was out there.
It's really funny that you say that, because actually there's been two moments, right, during his presidency where I was actually really scared. And I think the first one was with Kim Jong-un and North Korea, you know, when they had that extremely tense situation. And then that coupled with this false alarm in Hawaii.
Oh,
where
yes.
People in Hawaii, that was exactly at that moment, right? So had I been in Hawaii then, I would have taken it seriously. Like, but seriously, because it was so tense at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously things move so fast, we've already forgotten about it, but that was terrifying for people. People hid their kids in sewers, right? Googling, like, what to do in a nuclear attack. And the fact that we're sort of living through that and, you know, it was so bizarre. And I was really, really worried there how quickly things can escalate. And the other thing was really his last week in office, you know, seeing the, you know, kind of him slowly losing his mind, like the disconnect from reality, having Nancy Pelosi, right, calling the military to try to get assurance that they would stage a coup if he tried to do it. I mean, because that's basically what she asked them.
Yeah.
That the military would disobey the orders of a democratically elected president. That's the definition of a coup. So I think that, you know, that was also extremely nerve-wracking. But I think that one of the most difficult things during these 4 years has also been the distraction it's been. Like the mental space and the energy that him and his comments, and you get very much sucked into it. And I think that all also journalists probably have had this, like, does he say today, right? And then you get like the whole day is spent on responding or like explaining, and we're outraged and we tweet very angrily that this is the worst thing he's ever done. And then the next day, it's something else that they throw at you. And it makes you also forget that you have work to do, right? Like, so one of the things that I felt also kind of already in December when, you know, people moved on from the election, right? Like, you know, the election, yes, they were still contesting it, but most people agree that Biden is the president. It's going to be a new president. There was this like huge relief on not just because of him, but also like, I don't care what he says anymore. I don't have to respond to it. I don't have to think about it. Now, all of this energy we can spend on trying to make things better, right? Not spend the time being angry about what he just said and being out. Like, it's become this whole, like, thing that you've engaged in over the last 4 years. And I'm not going to lie. Like, you know, some of it has been, you know, very beneficial for people against Trump, right? Like, it's been a marketing thing, right? Like, you say something, Trump is so bad, and you argue and you get lots of retweets and you get lots of attention, but it's like it's not a productive attention. It's not a productive result, and it doesn't lead us forward. So I'm quite excited now about having, you know, I don't agree with this president on the nuclear weapons issue either, but I now have the mind space and the energy to push further and to look for progress rather than just trying to fight fires all the time.
In 2017, you put together this, you know, this treaty, and you get a bunch of nations to rally around it. The nine nuclear nations obviously don't, their allies don't. And I would imagine during this time you approach these nine nuclear nations. Were there any in those conversations that gave you the slightest inclination that they were open to the idea, or gave you a sense that, yeah, we want to move away from nuclear weapons, but ... Try and give me a sense of what those conversations entail.
I think one of the things is important to separate like the different parts of government as well. You can have a government official who sits at the State Department or equivalent in other countries saying absolutely not, never going to happen. But then you have senators and Congress people and parliamentarians who say, interesting, we're going to look at this. And yes, I'm going to work for this. And maybe I don't have a majority behind me in parliament here, but I'm going to work for this. So you have other institutions in the country that are like, oh yeah, no, actually we need to think about this. And that money could be used for other things that we see as a better priority at this point. So I do think that there's just, you know, sometimes we look at governments and it's like we only see the leader and think that that's all there is. But there is just so many different aspects of deciding what a country does. Like, it's not just one person. So I think that that gives me a lot of hope. And I think that that should also empower people to think about activism as, you know, you don't just have to go to the government and get an answer and that's it, right? Like, there's 100 different entry points and 100 different types of actors that somehow can shape and influence, maybe not the decision today, but the decision tomorrow and in the future. So I've had some incredible conversations with a lot of these people in different roles and on different levels and in different places in these countries, where it gives me, you know, confidence that, you know, also based on the past, we know that things will change eventually.
I like to try and be optimistic like that, but I see too many things that tell me no. And especially in the United States, I mean, I could see a Parkland shooting, a Sandy Hook, and all these gun tragedies, and nothing changes. Mm-hmm. Nothing gets passed legislation-wise. So it's always difficult for me. I hate to sound like the pessimist to your optimism, but I always find it so difficult to be positive that there is going to be a change, because so much, and you know this as well as anybody, so many governments around the world are reactive as opposed to proactive, especially the major, you know, nuclear powers, the superpowers of the world. They're more reactive than they are proactive. It takes something happening for a change to take place. There always needs to be the disaster first. A 9/11 happens, then we decide we're going to make airports safer and you got to take off your shoes and you know, all these different things. So for me, it's hard sometimes to come around to the idea that, yeah, eventually there will be change and we'll get there.
I think you can see a lot of kind of things that have happened, right? And I think a lot of times when there's a moment that, you know, triggers change, we like to think of it as it was the moment that triggered change, but very often there's also movements prepared for that moment, right? So they've been mobilizing and rallying for decades in advance so they can utilize these moments. And I think that that's also something really important to think about. And I was just, you know, think about things, you know, we write history based on individuals, but change doesn't come through an individual person. But that's how we kind of describe things like MLK and Nelson Mandela. And we kind of dismiss the organizing and the groundwork. And I read this really interesting thing that people miss about, for example, Rosa Parks, right? Like the Montgomery bus strike, and people kind of, you know, she took this decision to sit down on the bus and that was it. I mean, she was a trained activist. She got a scholarship to go to an education that taught people different ways of disobedience. How do you protest against different things? And so, like, we only see that like one action, but right, there was a whole kind of set of people that organized and organized that course and organized those scholarships and paid for those scholarships that kind of led to these movements. So I think that, you know, sometimes in history writing, we're not very good at describing that or valuing that. But I also think that, you know, we sometimes forget about how much we have achieved and how much we have changed. And I think about things like, for example, in the United States, gay marriage, for example, something that no presidential candidate was in favor of. Not even Obama the first time, right? Yeah. Like, he would not go on the record and say that he wanted that. And then people just changed, and state by state and pop culture and, like, you know, the society just kind of like tumbled, and suddenly everyone is in favor of it and nobody would like argue that they wouldn't be in favor of it. So it's also about the kind of building the pressure points on these politicians. Politicians don't lead. I mean, they reflect society. They will say no until it's not acceptable to say no, and they will have to say yes. So I can stay positive because I can sort of see how, you know, it's not really about convincing them. It was never about convincing the people who don't think that gay people should get married. It was about convincing all the other people that this is normal. This is the standard. This is that kind of stuff is unacceptable. And then you just kind of, you know, overwhelm them with that and just kind of raise the expectation and raise the norm in society that this is what's the new normal. Smoking ban, for example, you know, even when I was a teenager, like, it was normal to smoke in restaurants. And it's so unacceptable now. Yeah. Like, imagine just sitting in a restaurant and pulling up a cigarette or
sure.
indoors. Like, so weird, but we did it. And I remember how it was when the new law in Sweden came, and people were like, oh, that's going to be disastrous. People would never agree to that. People in France would never agree to that. And what do we see? Like, nobody, you know, smokes inside. So I think that the sort of shifts, and I'm not saying that it's the same kind of issues always, it's not, but I think that as a society, we also kind of underestimate the changes that have happened, and we kind of take them for granted. And we take that, like, well, that was just because it was time for that, or it was because of other reason. But we kind of undervalue the fact that people were active and people made those things happen and people took decisions and put laws and put, you know, state by state laws and that kind of stuff to get it to happen. So I do think that change will happen on most things, and some things will for the worse, right? Like, it's just that continuing as status quo, that's also a decision people make.
In the hours leading up to our conversation, I saw that the U.S. and Russia extended the nuclear arms control treaty to 2026, which is obviously some measure of good news. Do you anticipate being able to have a conversation with the new administration, and how do you go about making that happen, and how long does it take to get on their radar given all the other things they have to work with right now?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's been a huge amount of activity from the administration already in things like climate change, in the WHO, you know, and we know that climate change and getting the pandemic sort of under control will be the two priorities. But I think it was a really good sign that just a week after the new administration in place, they extended this new treaty. I think that's a good sign. And I think it was good that it happened so early so that it doesn't get, you know, put forward as the big accomplishment, right? Like, week one, that's done. Now we have 4 years to do something more. because this kind of, you know, because I think it's also important for activists to put pressure. It's not enough just to not be Trump. Because Obama, he was great, but we got Trump after that, right? So we have to move forward and we have to kind of push the envelope. I know several of the people who are now taking over some of these roles in the State Department. And I think that they're bringing in, like, a lot of Obama's old team.
Yes.
A lot of very skillful people.
Do you like that? Or would you have liked to have seen more new blood?
I think it's always, like, it's important to kind of bring in new people for kind of new perspective. I think there's an importance to bring in younger people. It's important to bring more diverse people and from different backgrounds. But I think they're doing a pretty good job. And I think that there's some good people in place. But I think also, like, you know, there are limits to what individuals in these positions can do. And what I see, and, you know, the Biden administration is not going to support getting rid of nuclear weapons immediately the way we would like to. But I do see, of course, a lot more scope for engagement and having conversations. And, you know, from, you know, our strategy is also to, you know, push the limits of what is possible and to be sort of the advanced mission, right? Like, to, you have to ask for a lot, and activists have to be really radical in order to move politicians. Because I think that you can see that also on things like Black Lives Matter and the climate change campaigners, the Me Too. Like, you know, if you charge ahead with activism, right, like, the politicians have to catch up and they have to kind of move closer. And there's sometimes a sort of strong push to tell activists or to tell sort of NGOs that don't be so radical, settle for less, you have to compromise. But I think it's not our job to compromise, right? That's the politician's job. Like, they are the ones who will compromise. We will ask for all of it, and maybe we'll get half if we're lucky. So I think that's the way we want to approach this administration, that we can kind of, you know, increase the motivation, increase the scope where we can take this kind of action and where we can push them to take further steps. And sometimes that is by complaining and saying you're not doing enough. And it's tough love. It's not to kind of, like, applaud and say you're doing amazing, but to say you need to do more.
Again, part two of my conversation with Beatrice Finn will be available on all podcasting platforms on Tuesday morning. She has a lot of interesting things to say. You're going to want to listen. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast, and you'll have that interview for you the moment it hits your platform.
Number one.
Our final story for this week comes from sports, and it's been written by Tom Brady. And the story is this. He's the single greatest team sports athlete of all time. It isn't Jordan or Gretzky. Not Montana or Babe Ruth, not Messi, Ronaldo, or Pele. It's Tom Brady. Period. Full stop. Brady racked up his seventh Super Bowl win in 10 tries in Super Bowl 55. He did it as an underdog to a juggernaut Kansas City Chiefs team that has an offense few can keep up with. He did it in his first season with a new team after spending the first 20 years of his career with one team and one head coach. He did it with an abbreviated offseason, and in a season unlike any other in NFL history. And he did it at 43 years of age, and coming off a previous season where many wondered if it was time for him to hang it up. The stats will say that Brady only threw for 201 yards, but he executed a brilliant game plan in a 31-9 win, while he executed it to perfection. He threw three touchdowns to a familiar face, couple of them to Rob Gronkowski, and he cemented his legacy as a face that should have a mountain all to itself when we talk about the legends of not just football, but team sports in general. I've never been a Tom Brady pom-pom waver. There are things about him that I'm not particularly fond of, but those could be discussed another day, another time. Sticking purely to sports, he is the greatest ever, and we should all count ourselves as fortunate for being able to bear witness to a once-in-a-lifetime sort of talent. And that is how we conclude this latest episode of the Intersection Podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. A big announcement to make before we say goodbye. Intersecting Media now has a new offering. Proud to announce the launch of the Intersection Newsletter. It comes courtesy of Substack. If you love the podcast, you'll love the newsletter. intersectingmedia.substack.com. That's intersectingmedia.substack.com. It's the address to find us and subscribe. It's free as we launch it. Free. Get it now because it won't be free forever. I do have to make money at some point in my life. Now, you might be asking what you get inside this newsletter. Here's the deal. Nobody has time to go and look for the big stories making news around the globe. We are suffering these days from an information shortage. I'm going to do the heavy lifting for you. Each day, you'll start your morning with five stories to help get your day going. Sports, politics, entertainment, business, tech, lifestyle stuff. It'll all be there for you each morning with some opinions from yours truly. I'm looking forward to bringing it to you. I hope you'll subscribe. Also, don't forget, check out my nightly video broadcast, Up Late with Jason Page. We're on Facebook Live, Twitch, YouTube, and Twitter, 11 p.m. Eastern on the East Coast in the United States. Subscribe to our Intersecting Media channels on those platforms as well. We're off and running in 2021. That's a wrap for this week. Stay safe, mask up. I'm Jason Page. I'll see you back here next week for the Intersection Podcast from Believe.